You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alexandra Brodsky, author of Sexual Justice, Supporting Victims, Ensuring Due Process, and Resisting the Conservative Backlash. Meanwhile, painful infrastructure negotiations continue as Biden met with congressional Democrats yesterday, and the White House thinks they've finally gotten the Manchin cinema wing to hang their hat on a dollar figure that they'll offer to the rest of the caucus. So hopefully the negotiating against ourselves portion of the process is done. Meanwhile, the threat of a government shutdown gets more real as Republicans seem to hold firm on filibustering the funding bill. The Office of Management and Budget has braced for impact, sending out guidance on a potential shutdown. However, putting the funding and debt ceiling package through reconciliation does remain an option. As the FDA authorizes Pfizer booster shots for those at high risk and 65 and older, the White House announced it will buy 500 million Pfizer shots for global donation. Still insufficient for those inequities, but and much less effective than, say, waiving patents, which Biden in public says he supports in private.
We gotta look into a little more.
An attempt at a bipartisan police reform bill is officially dead in the Senate, meaning the federal government has taken zero legislative action in the wake of George Floyd's murder. Great for Democratic fundraising, though.
They kneeled.
They did kneel, and they wore kente cloth. New York City is set to pass a measure securing minimum pay bathroom access and tip security for its delivery drivers, a good step forward as Prop 22 is tied up in California courts. And lastly, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has quit in disgust over the treatment of Haitian asylum seekers in a scathing resignation letter. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, Sam is out, and obviously, it's an Emma and Matt and Bradley Thursday. Welcome to the program. Welcome to the real fun day of the week. We know tomorrow's casual Friday, but this is when
Boss is gone.
Yeah, and so time to start the show a few minutes late, but you know, Sam does that too, so I think we're okay.
More than you do, frankly.
More than I do. Would you say that I'm a more timely host?
Yes.
Huh. Well, there you go. And I will continue to move the show along smoothly by transitioning in a beautiful way to the Bernie Sanders clip that we have teed up for you. So, Bernie Sanders is the Senate Budget Committee Chair, and I'm not sure if you're aware of that. It was a pretty big deal. And so he's been at the center of these infrastructure negotiations. Now, understand that he initially floated a $6 trillion infrastructure figure. All of this is spread out over 10 years. So
that's a key point. This is not like $6 trillion, which we could use in a single year with how much we've neglected our basic infrastructure.
Right.
But this is stretched out over 10 years.
But notice how there are other bills that the media will frame as their only their spending in a current year. They choose to, for this bill, refer to it as $3.5 trillion, etc. So anyway, he ended up landing on the $3.5 trillion figure over 10 years. So there was already a compromise. There were already cuts. And yet, this is the way that Gayle King and the rest of the CBS Morning Show crew approached their interview with Sanders, despite the fact that they're already a little under half of his initial ask as budget chair. Will you agree to cut? Will you agree to cut? It doesn't matter substantively what the cut is, what is getting cut, but we need cuts. We need, this is the talking point that that our producers gave to us. And this is where we stand on the political spectrum. And this is the line of questioning you can expect from the mainstream press. any cut, any blood, any scalp from the bill. That's what we need. But Bernie reframed the question really well.
Consider a number less than $3.5 trillion?
No, right. Look, we're talking about numbers. You tell me what we should cut. Tell the working families of this country that we don't need to make child care affordable. Tell the American people and the younger people that we should not address the crisis of climate change and try to save the planet. Tell the homeless people that we should not build affordable housing. Tell the young people that we should not make community colleges tuition free. All we are trying to do is address the crises facing working families and demand that the wealthiest people in this country start paying their fair share of taxes. They are fighting back big time. But at the end of the day, I believe we're going to prevail.
And we hope that they're going to prevail. Now, it seems that Pelosi is confident. I read a retelling of one of these. It might have been Punchbowl or something like that. One Democratic staffer says, she's got that look in her eye. Like, oh, God, it's time for the real negotiating to happen. So they are actually trying to get this reconciliation framework done in time for this promised vote on Monday, which still seems incredibly unrealistic. Biden has resisted calls from progressives to push back that September 27th date because there's potentially not enough time for there to be the negotiation process that is necessary to get things done for that two-bill track to happen. But as of now, that doesn't seem to be in Biden's plans. However, the thing that is in our favor is that this is all of Biden's agenda, essentially, wrapped into this reconciliation package. He needs this to pass as much as the progressives who want this for principled reasons need it to pass. And so, for the first time in quite a while, the progressives are in lockstep with the administration, with the Democratic president, and that is good news for us. The bad news is that moderates have a bit of an advantage.
Home field advantage,
right. But it's more than that. It's like they're wearing pads and progressives have to tackle without any pads on. It's a significant advantage because they have corporate and moneyed interests on their side. And so they have the ability to stand firm and stand pat. And they also aren't principled in the way that they want to deliver for the American people. Progressives, Biden, Democratic leadership feel an urgency because they want to say they got something done before the midterms. And of course, progressives want these substantive changes for people. The centrist corporate types, colloquially called moderates, even though they are not, I might have just accidentally called them moderates then. They're able to play a game in a bit of a sociopathic way that those other actors aren't. So things are ramping up. Time will tell, but I appreciate Bernie Sanders' effort to reframe the conversation around cuts. This is not cuts for the sake of cuts. These are cuts that would affect housing, climate proposals, all of these important elements of the infrastructure package that are talked about without any understanding or any context about what those cuts contain. He brought it back to that, which is something he's been quite effective as a public figure and politician.
Yeah. We go the Bernie way, or the Democratic Party is corrupted by money to even do what a Joe Biden wants it to do.
One side says this, one side says that. Matt, I'm not sure about that. All right. We have to take a quick break. Sam will be speaking to you with some advertisements, and when we come back, we will be joined by Alexandra Brodsky, author of Sexual Justice Supporting Victims, Ensuring Due Process, and Resisting the Conservative Backlash. Be right back. Here you go, Sam.
Thank you, Emma.
Yes, folks. One of today's sponsors is a fan of the program. He is the proprietor of MySolarNerd.com. What is MySolarNerd.com? It is a consulting service from a longtime fan and listener who has years of experience working in the solar industry. And here's the thing. If you're a homeowner, you may have considered solar, but you didn't know where to start. And maybe, as we had an IMer actually earlier in the week talk to us, there are programs out there that end up trapping people in long-term leases that are problematic. Well, this is why Danny actually started MySolarNerd.com. Saw a lot of stuff that he thought was predatory. He didn't want to be involved in that. He is a supporter of solar technology and also doing it right, giving homeowners the best deal possible. A lot of homeowners aren't aware that there's solar options that are currently available. You don't know how to navigate this whole thing. That's where My Solar Nerd comes in. It is now possible to retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see a significant savings starting in their first year, and this is possible thanks to the Solar Investor Tax Credit. It is not going to be here forever. My Solar Nerd's mission is simple: help you find the best solar program for your home and make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. How do they do it? They do it by A, analyzing your usage, B, finding the best equipment for your needs, C, determining the incentives and financing you may qualify for, and then finally, project manage the process between you and the installers, obtaining permits, et cetera, et cetera. Look, don't wait. Some of those tax credits and incentives are sunsetting. The current 26% tax credit drops down to 22% next year before going away. If a project is completed by 12/31 of this year, that homeowner qualifies for the 26% tax credit, so there's still time for you. Some markets are prone to power outages, may actually qualify for off-the-grid backup solutions. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. Go to mysolarnerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now, and make sure that you select the Majority Report listener for how you heard about mysolarnerd.com. And that's the only way you're going to receive that $200 gift card upon installation. Let them know that we sent you. Check it out, mysolarnerd.com. And thank you to Aura for sponsoring today's program. Aura is giving our audience 40% off when you go to aura.com/majority. I want you to take a second. Think about all your online accounts. Think about your finances. Think about the different devices you have. Are you doing anything to protect them? Because if you're like most people, the answer, Emma, is no. And you're probably reusing your old passwords all over the place. A data breach to any one of those services could create a lot of problems for you. Someone sees that you're using this password on this site, then they go and they try a bunch of other sites with your email, and bingo bango. Every 10 seconds, someone becomes a victim of fraud or identity theft. A lot of these people never recover their stolen money. And even the ones who do, it's a huge hassle. Let's talk about how Aura can protect you. Aura is a new type of security service that protects your online data and devices with one simple subscription. You get alerted to fraud, you get alerted to threats, and fast. Like if your online accounts or passwords were leaked online, or if someone tries to open a bank account in your name, you'll know it. With an easy online dashboard and alerts sent straight to your phone, Aura keeps you in control and guides you through solving any issues. All plans come with $1 million in identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experienced U.S.-based customer support that has got your back. So if you want amazing protection from hackers and scammers and phishers and all those things, check out Aura. You get 40% off of all plans when you go to Aura, A-U-R-A.com, aura.com/majority. The link, of course, is in the YouTube and podcast description. Hey, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Now, sure you're aware, if you've attempted to go see a therapist, therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. A lot of people found telemedicine to be very helpful, particularly therapy during COVID. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who are just going to stick with that. I found it much more convenient. Obviously, a lot of stress coming out of a pandemic, a lot of stress during a pandemic. A lot of stress when there's not a pandemic. Therapy has been extremely helpful for me. It's always helpful to speak to someone. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason with no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. You can find the URL in the description of this video or podcast, and check it out.
We are back. And I would like to welcome to the program Alexandra Brodsky, author of Sexual Justice, Supporting Victims, Ensuring Due Process, and Resisting the Conservative Backlash. Welcome to the show, Alexandra. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So I loved your book, and I really appreciated some of the background and reading about how you were at the center of student activism on sexual harassment and abuse as a student back before the Me Too era really was what it is today. And so I guess it's a good place to start if you could tell us a little bit about your background there and how that led you to focusing on this topic.
Sure. So I started college back in 2008. And this was, you know, in some ways, it feels like not that long ago. But in terms of the politics of sexual harassment, it really feels like another era. You know, when I started school, I knew that Title IX had something to do with student athletics. And that's basically it. I didn't know it had any protections for survivors of sexual assault. And during my time as a student, I saw how young people could create change on college campuses to better support survivors of sexual assault using, you know, protests and writing and ultimately the law. I was part of a group of 16 students and young alumni who filed a complaint against my alma mater when I was a student, saying that they needed to better follow the civil rights law, Title IX, to protect the educations of student survivors of sexual assault. And that, for me, was a really eye-opening experience, both about the power of the law. I think it's a big part of why I'm a lawyer working on sexual harassment issues today, why I went to law school to begin with. And it was also a way for me to connect with young people across the country on all kinds of campuses, colleges, and high schools to learn about the common threads through our experiences and what, you know, what people needed from their schools so that they could continue to learn.
So what were some of those common threads that you were able to find from connecting with other students who shared some of the experiences that you did?
I mean, one of the biggest things that we saw was that everyone learned about their rights too late. You know, people 2 years after they reported to their school or tried to report to their school would say, oh, hey, there's this law, Title IX, that protected me. That meant that the school was supposed to do X, Y, and Z then. But it was always too late. So through a group, Know Your Nine, that I co-founded, we took on the work of making sure that other young people knew their rights. And, you know, there's so much debate today about the procedures that schools use to investigate sexual assault. And that is in large part the topic of my book. So I certainly think that that's important. But I was reflecting recently on how when we first started, so this is, you know, 2011, 2012, our concerns were so much more basic than that. No one was talking about the particular procedures that a school might use because schools didn't have accessible procedures to begin with. No one knew where to report. And when people did come forward, they were so often told, you know, that they, if they reported, they would be retaliated against, that, you know, instead they should just take time off and wait until their rapist graduated. So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in this area, but in some ways, publishing the book has been a nice moment to reflect on really how much progress we've seen over the last decade.
Right. And what sticks out in my mind from that particular time period was the Columbia University controversy, which I think I remember the focus of that conversation being, oh, well, what about false accusations? And that being a lot of the central focus of conversations around assault and harassment on college campuses in particular. Is that a lot of what you faced when you were trying to maybe focus these conversations in a different way?
Yeah, that was such really a pivotal moment. I think that for so many people, or for so many survivors, they saw Emma Silkowitz's performance carrying that mattress. The whole performance was called Carry That Weight. And that felt like such a moving metaphor for the experience of trying to learn, trying to move around campus and always having this psychological weight to bear. But for a lot of people, you're right, they came to the conversation first and foremost concerned about the guy that Emma was accusing and what that experience, whether that was fair to them. And, I think what I have tried to do with this book is to say there are too many people who feel like they have to choose a side, right? They feel like they have to choose that they're on the side of the victim or they're on the side of the accused. And once they choose that side, they're there forever and they can't care about the other. But the truth is that I think that the right position, the position that I actually think, certainly most feminists have, is, of course, justice for survivors is incredibly important. Of course, we need to make sure that, whether someone's assaulted at in school or in the workplace or whatever, that they can move on with their lives in the way that they want to. And also, of course, it's important that people accused of these harms are treated fairly, because every kind of allegation should be vetted in a way that's fair to the accused. And the kinds of procedures that the accused are often asking for, the opportunity to tell their side of the story, the opportunity to be heard by an unbiased decision maker, those are the exact same things that survivors have been asking for. So, fair procedures ultimately benefit everyone.
Right. And I guess I want to tackle that question, that thorny question of due process within institutions. Of course, it's a separate, I think, conversation when we're talking about the penal system or the legal system. But I think the word due process in the context of Me Too has been weaponized by people who want to shut down the conversation entirely. And so that's an important note, but it also is a real concern. And I want to have a good faith conversation about it with you, because I really respected how you chose to talk about that in your book and allowed for us to have a path forward talking about due process without making it a weaponizing it in a way to shut down accusations.
Yeah, it's so hard. And I feel like I've been dealing with this in the backlash since I was a student. I see it now a lot as an attorney, where so often when you hear people saying, what about due process for the accused? What about due process for men? Really what they mean is, it's inherently unfair that you would accuse a man of doing anything wrong. It is inherently unfair that someone might get into trouble for sexual harassment. And that can't be right. And we know that that can't be right. But, I think that it can't be that our response to that is to not care about due process at all. Instead, we have to be able to, hold in our head two ideas, that these values of due process are really important, and also that they're being weaponized. And, it's tricky. I'm not going to pretend that this is easy. It's always been tricky for me to figure out who are the people coming to this conversation in good faith, trying to answer real hard questions about what do we do when an allegation like this is lodged? What does it mean to be fair to everyone involved? And then who are the people who are using this as a dog whistle? And for me, a guiding principle that has been useful is to look out for what I call exceptionalism, which basically means, are people, so there's this history throughout American law of courts singling out allegations of sexual assault for uniquely onerous procedures. So special rules that made it particularly hard for rape victims to prove their cases. And the justification for this, and it wasn't subtle, it was written, the justification for this was that women lie because they feel scorned or they get pregnant and they're ashamed. And so we have to protect men from these dubious allegations. Now, of course, sexual assault allegations are not more likely to be false than other serious crimes, but there's certainly a cultural perception that they are. And luckily, American courts have mostly gotten rid of that exceptionalism. But we've seen how that same spirit infects conversations about how schools and workplaces and the media should treat these kinds of allegations, that they have to be particularly suspicious, that the procedures have to be, you know, particularly onerous. And so in my mind, you know, a clarifying question is this person making a critique about procedure that is where they're concerned about procedures for all kinds of allegations, or are they singling out sexual assault and sexual harassment for special treatment? And that, for me, that singling out is a real red flag, that they're motivated not by real concern for due process, but by, you know, rape apologism and misogyny.
Yeah, it's a trope that I've been noticing, honestly, in my critiques of the Biden administration from the left, is when we're talking about procedure, sometimes that is just used to present this faulty notion of institutional obstacles that it sounds so insurmountable when we're talking about procedure upon procedure, and it sometimes convolutes things and people are unable to see the bigger picture. But it really is, I think, a through line in ways to shut down conversations about holding a powerful group, wherever that group resides, accountable. That I don't know. I have a little bit of dog ears for.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me is that, you know, the parliamentarian in the Senate,
yes,
where we have, you know, this one person who gets to, because of some wonky procedure, gets to hold up incredibly important federal legislation. And we treat that as though, oh, well, you know, that's just the process. There's nothing we can do about it, without looking at what are the values that that process upholds. You know, what is the anti-democratic function of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a perfect example for what I'm talking about, but I don't want to get too off track. Now, something that I love that you did was, you know, so much of the national Me Too conversation was focused on famous people, mm-hmm. Harvey Weinstein and his, of course, oftentimes high profile victims, sometimes not. And I don't know, other celebrities who were accused of sexual misconduct. And I think your choice not to focus on famous perpetrators and men here was really well placed, because so much of sexual harassment and violence and misconduct that is directed at, say, on college campuses or in the workplace, that's not going to get a national news headline. And that's where it can be the most pervasive in many ways, because there's not a spotlight on that. I'm wondering if you can expand a little upon those power dynamics within the power dynamic, the kind of Russian doll situation, and how that informed some of the stories you chose to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the book talks a little bit about some examples about famous men. So, you know, Harvey Weinstein, Brett Kavanaugh, because those are stories that we all have access to, right? And even though everyone has survivors in their lives, not everyone knows that they have survivors in their lives. So their sort of most obvious connection to sexual assaults might be to a famous person. But the truth is that the dynamics there are just so different. You know, so many of the conversations that we have about, let's say, fairness to the accused, when we're talking about famous people, are really just extraordinary and unique circumstances. So the question of when should a newspaper report on an allegation of sexual assault? You know, how much digging do they have to do? How much proof do they need before they run the allegation in a paper? That's an important question. It's an interesting question. It's one where I think that these concerns about exceptionalism comes up again. But is that going to be applicable to the, you know, more than, you know, 150 people in the world who are the most famous? No, of course not. You know, if I'm sexually harassed in the workplace, no one is going to write a story about that. And, you know, so I worry sometimes that we get a little distracted by those questions. Same thing with, you know, I write about the confirmation hearings for Justice Kavanaugh, because there was so much interesting discussion about sexual harassment and due process around those confirmation hearings. But ultimately, my conclusion is there's really nothing to be learned about due process from these hearings, either, you know, as a model or as a model of it going well or as a model of it going poorly, because it was an inherently politicized process that just isn't really, that doesn't tell us much about how this is going to work in everyday workplaces or schools. So, you know, what I wanted to pay attention to was how does sexual harassment affect everyday people, either who are victims or who are accused? So one thing that I think has really gotten buried in these discussions is what our debates about sexual harassment and due process tell us about the nature of American labor writ large. So there have been a lot of, you know, especially, you know, in 2017, 2018, there were a whole bunch of articles about, you know, movie stars being accused of sexual harassment and missing out on contracts and, you know, op-ed columnists saying, well, you know, what this means is men are just getting fired at a mere accusation. And I have no idea if that is true in a broad sense. I don't think that we have any data to suggest it is. But to me, the actually really interesting nugget of truth in there is most American workers can be fired at any time for any reason. They can walk in tomorrow and their boss says, you know, I don't like, you know, your shirt, you're wearing a blue shirt, I don't like the color blue, you're fired, because most, you know, private workers aren't unionized, don't have those kinds of protections. And so by focusing, taking, sort of looking away from Hollywood, looking away from, you know, famous accused, and thinking about what we, you know, what protections real ordinary people accused of sexual harassment might need, that actually tells us a broader story about American labor that goes beyond just sexual harassment alone.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to ask you to expand more on that story, because what also fascinates me and depresses me is how harassment can be compounded when someone is targeted by the harasser, and how that can green light and signal to other employees or other people working with that person. There's a gang up mentality, and it becomes about domination. Often, say, if the harasser is the boss, and if that influences other coworkers of this person, it's this awful dynamic in which we see in so much of American capitalism, where workers are fighting amongst themselves and the powerful are cloistered off and free of consequences. What were some of the stories that you came across, and how that how those stories intersected with broader capitalist dynamics in this country?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you're absolutely right. So all workers, or I shouldn't say all workers, but so many workers in the U.S., you know, are, their employment is incredibly precarious. And the truth is that generally, the less money you're making, the more precarious your employment is. And so, you know, we see how, you know, I talk in the book about how there are CEOs who have these contracts that say that they can only be fired for good cause. And then it defines good cause. And that means that even if they are found to have sexually harassed someone, it might still be contrary to the contract for their employer to fire them. Now contrast that with a domestic worker who, you know, let's say cleans houses and right now isn't protected by federal anti-discrimination law, has no protections in most states against sexual harassment. Or think about, you know, private non-union worker who faces an accusation of wrongdoing and just has, you know, has no way to fight back, has no rights that have been violated if they're summarily fired. And so, you know, I think you're 100% right that what ends up happening there is just, where does the power lie in that workplace? And if the power lies, as it generally does, with, you know, against the survivor, they're going to be disbelieved. They're going to be retaliated. You know, they might come forward and report harassment and end up being the one who's fired. But if, you know, it's the rare instance where the power lies with the person levying the allegation, or if a workplace just kind of doesn't want to deal with an investigation, all of their workers are, you know, equally dispensable to them, the person who's accused might not have the opportunity to tell their side of the story and be treated fairly because they just have no legal right to do so. And so that's a place where, you know, I talk about the law in the book. I draw on principles of what due process means, you know, under American law. But ultimately, legal protections for workers, for students are so much thinner than we want them to be that I think we can use due process as an ethical basement, but it's never going to be our ultimate aspiration.
I'm not trying to harp on this, but I just love this angle, and I think it's so important to flesh out just how, one, you know, maybe the lack of union protections for contract workers, gig workers, and we're talking about this in the context of, you know, for example, Prop 22, which we cover on the show a good amount, which is a separate, you know, delivery workers. I'm not sure what the statistics are on harassment for them. Mistreatment is obviously rampant, but just the rise of even non-competes for somebody working in a minimum wage job at a Jimmy John's or something like that, how the structure of contracts and protections, which you just talked about a bit, for lower wage workers have over time deteriorated to such a degree, and protections for higher executives and middle management have increased, that I would imagine that is an under-discussed element of Me Too and harassment, because, you know, it's within the context of broader worker protections, which seemingly no one in this country who is powerful and has money wants to talk about.
I entirely agree. And so, I mean, to some extent, I think that this goes back to what you were talking about earlier, where there's so much focus on celebrities who, you know, may be subject to terrible sexual harassment, but are just going to be in a fundamentally different position than, right, an Uber Eats driver who's harassed by a customer. And because they're an independent contractor rather than an employee, it won't be protected by federal law. Their employer will have no obligation to do anything in that situation to protect them. And now there are some states that are starting to protect independent contractors from sexual harassment. There are efforts on the federal level to extend civil rights protections to independent contractors, but right now, incredibly precarious. And then I think, you know, thinking about the accused, it's interesting to me to have seen a lot of concern from conservative critics about how people accused, you know, workers accused of sexual harassment are being treated. They have never spared a sentence in one of their columns for how, you know, workers, how susceptible workers are to unfair termination in general, you know, especially low wage workers. And so it's very clear that what they're really motivated by is a sense that, oh, Me Too has gone too far, you know, survivors are too powerful, which is laughable, and not that they're actually concerned about workers missing out on a paycheck,
or it's a way terminated, right? Or it's a way to critique Hollywood elites, which is, you know, something that's a Tucker Carlson playbook, right? And then you can kind of sprinkle in some cue dog whistles. Oh, look, they're all sexually deviant and the liberal elite, etc. And then that's as far as it goes, of course.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's such a long story of especially conservatives talking about sexual harassment that only rich white women care about. I mean, this came up when Anita Hill testified about sexual harassment. And there's a lot of talk, and Kimberly Crenshaw writes about this, that essentially, you know, this is a white person problem. When, of course, low-income workers of color are going to be particularly vulnerable to harassment because they lack the, you know, structural power in the workplace, because they, you know, don't have the generational wealth to fall back on that would allow them to, you know, safely speak up, safely push back.
Right, right. There's a variety of hypocrisies there that we could talk about at length. But I mean, I also want to touch somewhat on the gender elements and the racial elements, since we talked about the capitalist elements as well. Now, I think this has been highlighted just socially in talking about the Gabby Petito case, where she's the victim, obviously, of a murder, which is awful, but the attention paid to young white women who are missing or killed is amplified to an amazing degree versus how we treat black and non-white and indigenous people in this country who are missing. And then this, of course, the same dynamic socially is in the workplace and in Me Too as well. in your work, how much have you seen the disparity between belief and responses to white accusers, and not just women, of course, this can be men who have been victims of sexual harassment and assault as well, and non-binary people, and then of course Black, Latino, Indigenous, or Asian reporters of victims of sexual harassment and assault?
I mean, I think that the disparities are really undeniable. I mean, I remember being a young student organizer, so, 21, 22, and it was just really clear that, TV stations wanted a pretty white girl to cry on TV. And that, that was what they thought made for a compelling story about sexual violence. And when there, when students of color were talking about their experiences, when undocumented students were talking about their fear of coming forward because they feared that there would be immigration consequences for them, that was a quote unquote alternative story, a complicated story. When non-binary survivors wanted to come forward, when male survivors wanted to come forward, I remember a producer telling some members of our team that was a little too complicated of a story for them to tell. And wow. I think that we see that also in some conversations where it's assumed that justice for survivors is in tension with racial justice rather than a form of racial justice. I think in our popular imagination, race comes into play in sexual assault allegations when it's a white woman accusing a Black man of sexual assault. And of course that happens. And of course there's a terrible history of trumped up allegations against Black men for assaulting white women have been used to justify racist violence. But it's also true that sexual violence toward Black people and especially Black women by white people has been a tool of racial terrorism. One of the KKK's go-to forms of violence was gang rape of Black women. And during slavery, Black women and Black men were sexually brutalized. And today we see how think about the R. Kelly story, that when Black girls, Black women have tried to come forward about their stories, it's much harder for them to get media attention, corporate attention. For in the R. Kelly instance, there were whistleblowers, survivors coming forward for decades before media, the law caught up to that. And so I think we have to just recognize that, ultimately justice for survivors is a racial justice issue.
And I guess I want to talk about the dynamic of men versus women as accusers and as victims and as perpetrators, because of course there is, it is more likely to happen to women as society stands today, but there are male victims who do not get attention and are often treated with really vile derision. And I feel that there is still a gap in understanding about how much of sexual harassment and violence is about exerting power, and people who may not have experience with this have a really difficult time untangling the sexual harassment and violence from sexual, right? That word, there is less of an understanding about how power dynamics unravel themselves in these contexts. So do you mind expanding on that a bit so people have the literacy to understand?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this is an area where requires a really nuanced response because, as you said, the truth is that right now, the majority of sexual violence, sexual harassment is, men hurting women. And I don't, that's not a coincidence. That reflects broader power dynamics. But there are, people of all genders hurt people of all genders. And in any sort of given situation, gender might not be the primary axis of inequality. So if you have a female boss and a male worker, it is true that woman is in, has less power in certain ways, but in that workplace, she's got power over the worker. Let's say she can decide whether he gets fired or not. So if she propositions him, that might not fit our idea about how sexual harassment works broadly, but it's going to have the same kinds of effects on, you know, that worker's ability to thrive and to stay in the workplace. And, you know, it's for good reason then, federal civil rights law that prohibits sexual harassment protects victims of all genders. And one thing that I've seen in my practice as an attorney is that, and I saw as an organizer, was that even though there are fewer male survivors, they face unique stereotypes when they try to come forward. So, you know, I should give the disclaimer that I'm not speaking for my employer here, but we recently had a case on behalf of a really young boy who was sexually assaulted by his classmates in a locker room repeatedly. And when he and his family went to the school, they said, you know, very explicitly, well, if your son were a girl, we would do something about this. But, you know, it's just boys' course playing. It's not sexual assault because it's between boys. And that, you know, in that situation, that was anti-male sex bias that was standing in the way of our client getting the kinds of support he needed, having the school put together a plan to keep him safe, and ultimately was hugely disruptive to his education.
Yeah, that's a pretty despicable response by the school. You want to think that when your kids go to school that there's some protections in place. That's you know, deeply disturbing. And I also just wanted to touch on this notion that I have particular resentment for. So just a forewarning that the way that the white feminist mentality has overtaken this, like, I think we've done a great job today, and your book did an amazing job of contextualizing Me Too in a way that isn't just about Sheryl Sandberg. not of course that she came out with these things, but like that kind of brand of corporate feminism that I'm allergic to, and also that I have resentment towards, because it is, I think, actually really counterproductive. And there have been reports recently about some of the turbulence in Me Too, with the board being dominated by necessarily women who aren't representative of the same people we've been centering our discussion on today. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you have a critique of that you might share with me.
Yeah, I mean, so I've been following the story about the Time's Up board closely, and I've got to say,
I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, it's all, you know, it's various hashtags, some of which have been useful and some of which have been questionable. Right. You know, and I should say, I think that the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which is sort of the legal wing of that organization, has been really effective. But I'm grateful for some of their efforts, but this sort of freestanding Times Up board, I was really disturbed to hear them explain their mission recently, which was very explicitly, well, we're powerful women, and that means we know powerful people. And so we'll use our connections to powerful people, and particularly powerful men, to take change, to make change. And the CEO who just stepped down was incredibly derisive about people who create change from the outside. She described it as, you know, it's not useful to just be, you know, yelling from outside. You got to get in the room. And but first of all, that is an incredibly ahistorical view of how social change has happened. You know, generally, it is, you know, there is never change that happens without a grassroots movement behind it. And also, I don't know if your whole idea of the value that you bring is knowing powerful men. I don't know how you could ever actually be disruptive. Because anything you do to threaten their power is going to get you kicked out of that room where that you think is the most important thing in the world. So that just seems to me like a fundamentally flawed vision of change making.
Right. It certainly does. And the whole lean in mentality is something that I think is like quite difficult for to square with actual change. But, you know, to each their own, I guess. I wanted to kind of end with a path forward, right? We I think talked a good amount about one. We did touch on due process at the start, but all of the different shades of sexual harassment and assault. And I think a lot of people who are maybe just passively following the news about Me Too feel there's a hopelessness or there's not necessarily a clear understanding of how we can move forward by being fair to the victims and, of course, giving due process to the accused. What is your, I guess, bullet-pointed proposal on how to address this conversation in the future?
Oh, I mean, I will say in some ways, this is just going to betray, you know, how law has shrunk in my brain in some ways. But I find a lot of hope in specificity. I think that when you follow the movement, when you follow the backlash as a culture war issue, as it's laid out in The Atlantic and Slate and all of that, it can really feel intractable. It can feel like there's been, you know, this backlash that maybe has something to say for it, and you've got to pick a side, and there's no way we're ever going to find a solution that works for everyone. But if you really sit down and think, what do workers need? What do students need when they experience sexual harassment or when they're accused of sexual harassment? There are a lot of concrete fixes that are low-hanging fruit. You know, again, sort of the basics of give everyone the chance to tell their side of the story. Make sure that they get a chance to, you know, provide their evidence. Make sure that they know how the process is going to work and are ultimately, you know, the decision is made by unbiased decision makers. And that's going to benefit everyone. And, you know, I will say also what gives me hope is that it can feel like we have been having this debate forever. I feel like we've been having this debate forever. But, you know, in federal law prohibiting sexual harassment, it's just a couple decades old. Coeducation in higher ed, just a couple decades. You know, we've seen that there are so many workplaces and schools that just over the past couple of years, for the first time, said, hey, maybe we should have a real sexual harassment policy. So I think that remembering that we're really at the start of this, we're at the start of getting it right. And that doesn't mean that we should have patience when institutions screw up. That doesn't mean that the problem isn't urgent, but we shouldn't throw up our hands just because we haven't, you know, we haven't perfected policy yet.
Yeah, and allow for messiness too, which is when activism is at its start. That's really what you have to expect. And sometimes I think people trying to detract from it point to the messiness to say, oh, it's impossible. But actually, that's just the function of what activism is like when things start out. But Alexandra Brodsky, author of Sexual Justice, Supporting Victims, Ensuring Due Process, and Resisting the Conservative Backlash. I really appreciate your time today. What a great discussion. Thanks so much, Alexandra.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking a little Tucker Carlson. So I feel like we haven't checked in on Tucker Carlson recently, and he's had some doozies. But last night, he had a segment in which, I don't know if projection is even the right word to talk about or encapsulate his commentary here. Tucker Carlson wants you to know about eugenics. He wants you to know about...
It's on his mind.
Yeah. He wants you to know about the Great Replacement, which is a white supremacist theory that has its roots in early 20th century European nationalism and then was adopted once again by white supremacists in the United States. If you recall the Jews will not replace us chant in Charlottesville, the rhetoric around Muslims in this country, around Afghan refugees, around black people, around native people, around Latino people at the border, of course. This rhetoric has been dominant and has been pushed forward by Tucker Carlson regularly, but he doesn't want you to know that he explicitly endorses eugenics. he doesn't want you to think that. No, he doesn't want you to think that he explicitly believes in, the Great Replacement white supremacist theory and that he regularly promulgates it on his program. He just wants to accuse the other side of adopting those ideas so that his viewers have eugenics and great replacement in their brain. And then when they choose to adopt what they perceive as the flip side of those concepts, it's quite acceptable to believe in eugenics and the great replacement. Because, look, Biden's doing it. And this is just our version. This is what Tucker had to say last night.
An unrelenting stream of immigration. But why? Well, Joe Biden just said it. To change the racial mix of the country. That's the reason. To reduce the political power of people whose ancestors lived here and dramatically increase the proportion of Americans newly arrived from the third world. And then Biden went further. He said that non-white DNA is the, quote, source of our strength. Imagine saying that. This is the language of eugenics. It's horrifying. But there's a reason Biden said it. In political terms, this policy is called the Great Replacement, the replacement of legacy Americans with more obedient people from faraway countries. They brag about it all the time. But if you dare to say it's happening, they will scream at you with maximum hysteria. And here you have Joe Biden confirming his motive on tape with a smile on his face.
So look at what he's doing there. That is not the definition of the Great Replacement. The Great Replacement Theory, as defined by the ADL, is what I just explained, is that it has been a white supremacist theory used to justify nationalist and extremist racist policies for decades and has been quite prevalent on the Tucker Carlson program. In fact, the Great Replacement Theory and language associated with it has been used by a variety of white supremacist terrorists and mass murderers in this country and internationally. The Tree of Life murderer who killed over 10 people at the synagogue in Pittsburgh a few years ago was echoing Great Replacement language. The New Zealand mosque mass killer who killed tens of people posted his manifesto online, and he talked about the Great Replacement explicitly. This is not a Biden left theory, but Tucker wants you to hear the words Great Replacement. He wants you to hear the words eugenics. Do your own research, aka go to one of those white supremacist forums that his ex-writer wrote on and talk a little bit amongst yourselves about your own version of the Great Replacement. Like, that is as gross as it gets.
Well, he's mapping it to the Republican Party and turning the average Republican into Nazis, or white supremacists. This is why when we were talking about how much Muslim refugees we should take from Afghanistan, for instance, he said, is this a plot for the Democrats to steal elections? Which is the exact same thing he's saying about Haitian
They can't vote,
refugees.
But yeah.
Like, is this a plot to steal elections? And that's his constant refrain. And it's interesting that certain people that appear on Tucker Carlson show will say things like, oh, this is the exact same thing as Trump did. I'm thinking about like Glenn Greenwald, for instance. How many Haitians should we take in? How many Haitians are you going to go on Tucker Carlson's for and advocate that we take in? Because I think we should take in quite a few. Maybe that's unpragmatic. I'm not sure where Glenn stands on things these days with regards to bringing in refugees. But Tucker wants them stopped before they get here. So he's probably very happy about rumors that we're reopening Gitmo to detain people. And he'd probably be happy with Mexico sinking them in the Gulf of Mexico before they even reach land. But I wonder, like, so yeah, Biden and Trump are doing the same thing. We agree with that. On the left, we agree with that. You can also agree with that on the right and use it to defend Trump. I wonder which way the people that go on Tucker Carlson show regularly feel about immigration.
Right. You know, Matt, what if you're truly trying to make change in this world and you're appearing on Tucker Carlson's program and you choose to call out regularly that the Biden administration is being as demonic as the Trump administration was on immigration. They are being as ridiculous, and you don't hear the liberals calling him out on the same in the same way. Right. OK, you want to point out that hypocrisy? Fine. Fine. Then go on Tucker Carlson's program and advocate for the taking of hundreds of thousands and more of refugees, because if this is actually politics and not just a vehicle for you to sneer at liberal hypocrisy, then you would be advocating for that. But then you get uninvited from Tucker Carlson's program, and that might be a little bit of a dent in your wallet.
Yeah.
So you're not going to do that.
So instead of, we talk about COVID being used by the security state to destroy civil liberties. we're going to go to college campuses to look at temporary COVID procedures for that. Michael Tracy and Glenn Greenwald is going to say you're a great journalist for doing that. And no, none of you mentioned Title 42 or where you stand on sending expelling people basically because they're not white. I mean, I would maybe spare a thought for Title 42 if you're a civil libertarian these days.
Yeah, right. And also another reminder for the 500 millionth time, no matter what you do, no matter how vile you are to Haitian asylum seekers along the border, and how you have Jen Psaki going on morning shows where she knows she'll get softball questions in order to defend the brutal treatment of Haitian asylum seekers at the border. No matter what you do, guys like Tucker and the right-wing media are going to pretend that you're being soft on the border, so you might as well do the right thing. He's doing this segment claiming that Biden is trying to replace white people in this country, or projecting about the great replacement theory onto him, essentially, that this is what it always boils down to.
Mapping it to electoral politics for Republicans, which is the dangerous thing about it.
Yeah. As you see the images of the Border Patrol officers on horseback and their treatment of Haitian asylum seekers at the border, I didn't watch the whole Tucker Carlson program last night, I'm sorry, or the rest of this week, but I didn't really see those images coming out because his bloodthirsty audience may like it. It gets in the way of the narrative, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, Tucker says nobody can defend this. Like, the only problem Tucker has with those, like, shanties under a bridge is that they're not, like, deep in Mexico, or those Haitians weren't, like, you know, stopped way, way, way before that point in a similar brutal fashion where we just wouldn't have images about it.
Right, right. But, you know, Tucker is unhappy that Biden didn't heed the wise advice of Donald Trump and put crocodiles in the Rio Grande.
And you have Sean Hannity out saying, like, actually, some are getting through. It's just like the most disgusting, vile, fascist sort of rhetoric, and it's despicable. And I think I also, Jimmy Dore, where do you stand on Title 42? What are you going to say about Title 42 and how many refugees we should take on Tucker Carlson show? Or is this just about liberal hegemony and, you know, moderating social media
and cultural resentment towards liberals, which is, you know, that's the most important thing in the world.
If that's your takeaway from this, that, oh, it's the same, you're just naturalizing it and basically defending Trump, in my opinion.
That is true. All right, Peacock viewers, we will see you tomorrow, and Sam will be back with us for this casual Friday. See ya. All right, and for the rest of us, we are going to head into the fun half. As a reminder, join the Majority Report, become a member. We rely on your support to continue to do this show, and we would really appreciate it. And, of course, if you would like to call in, I am turning off the voicemail here, so everyone will be able to call in, 646-257-3920. We will be taking a few calls, reading some IMs, talking about some more shenanigans, and Brandon is here. Brandon.
Hello, Emma. I am here. I heard there'd be shenanigans.
Yes, you always flock to the shenanigans, and so that's why I said that. Got you, like, on a hook. Matt, what's up, man?
How you doing?
I'm doing well. What's happening over on Doomed?
Oh, well, last night we did a stream. Usually we do Thursday nights, but sometimes you gotta do when the guest is available. And we had a great show last night at youtube.com/Matt Binder. You could catch the replay there. I had on Max Chafkin. He recently wrote a book about Peter Thiel. It's called The Contrarian, and we did a deep dive into Thiel and his history, his early life, his early political leanings, everything you ever wanted to know about the guy, the guy who basically shut down Gawker and was the most prominent Silicon Valley backer of Trump, was there for a lot of the private meetings that Trump held with people like Mark Zuckerberg. And the book goes into some details of what those meetings were about. It's just really fascinating interview. YouTube.com/Matt Binder. It'll be up as a podcast later this week at doomthecast.com. Check it out.
Is it about how he's fighting a valiant war against censorship?
Oh, yes, of course. We did bring up Rumble and Greenwald defending Peter Thiel and being one of his biggest, you know, supporters, it seems.
Supporters, but also a supporter of like Thiel invested candidates. And also, I mean, I'll just say Brett Weinstein, also one removed from Peter Thiel, defending him occasionally, or at least engaging with him on Twitter. It's interesting. Just little patterns about Peter Thiel.
The Gawker thing doesn't seem to come up in these free speech conversations.
Well, Glenn used to, I think, be anti the Peter Thiel did to Gawker, but he started sharing a lot of anti-Gawker sentiment in the last year. It's been if you search his tweets.
Right. And, you know, you should also know that Palantir basically put together this whole little promotional package to take out Glenn Greenwald back in the day. He was a big target of theirs, and they had a whole little project to go at him. And, you know, look where we are now.
Not so much now. Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
Well, we put out a new episode last week for Patreon subscribers, and we're going to be recording tomorrow. So ideally, we'll have a new episode out before the, you know, too early next week. But, you know, frankly, I want to say that we've been receiving a lot of like positive support for the quality of our episodes so far. And we're, you know, very humbled by that.
Okay. Good to know. I'm sure that the positive support is warranted. All right, folks, we're going
to
head. Oh,
wait, I need to
no, sorry,
stuff.
Matt. Sorry, Matt. Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
My bad.
So last night we have David Gerard.
I saw that. I was very pumped.
He's great. He is so fun. He's so funny. We talked about not only, you know, cryptocurrency and the speculative nonsense of it, but also like the more sort of rational things like blockchain and smart contracts and how those are also silly nonsense. So we probably won't, you know, satisfy people who want us to look into that as if it validates crypto. But we did look into it with David Gerard, who's a great, great thinker and writer on these topics. We also talked about more of this border stuff and how basically Biden is giving Tucker Carlson exactly what he wants with this Title 42 stuff and all the it's basically enabling border brutality, and it's pretty disgusting. And like we mentioned earlier, getting mad at the people that say this is the same. Well, which way is this, Tucker? Like, if you can't defend it, then which way are you criticizing it? Are you saying we should let Haitians in and humanize this border process, or are you saying lean on Mexico so they stop them brutally before we see this, which is what the Tucker Carlson view is? Anyway, we talked about that. Patreon.com/leftreckoning, and we also talked about Steven Crowder has basically an FBI critique for babies. I don't know if people watch Nathan Fielder, but FBI critiques for babies, where you think the guys with guns are good and the guys pushing pencils are the only bad guys in the FBI. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to hear that.
Yeah, Matt, I was trying to censor you, but you created a Rumble account and you got around that censorship there with Left Reckoning. Okay, 646.
Yo, we should. I mean, you know, I think I'm going to create a Rumble account. I think I'm going to get on there.
I'm not going to belong to any website called Rumble. It sounds like a dating site. It sounds like a site where you meet people to fight and screw.
Well, like, it sounds like Bumble, yeah. But instead of the what is it? The women asking them out. It's the women saying, "I'll punch you in the face."
I haven't looked into it. You know, either the fake app I've invented in my own head called Rumble or the real one.
646-257-3920. See you all in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back the
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Blast, come on. Blast, come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.